Okay, Luke chapter 20. Luke chapter 20. We're going to talk about first this evening the parable of the wine growers. And we find that in Luke 20, verses 9 through 18. So let's read the verses first, the parable of the vine growers. Luke 20, verse 9. And he began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard and rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey for a long time. At the harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers so that they would give him some of the produce of the vineyard. But the vine growers beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he proceeded to send another slave, and they beat him also and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. And he proceeded to send a third, and this one also they wounded and cast out. The owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the vine growers saw him, they reasoned with one another, saying, "This is the heir. Let us kill him so that the inheritance will be ours." So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy these vine growers and will give the vineyard to others. And when they heard it, they said, "May it never be." But Jesus looked at them and said, "What then is this that is written? The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like dust." Now, just as by way of introduction to this parable, notice there's a change of address. In verse 1 of chapter 20, Jesus was confronted by the chief priests, the scribes, with the elders. And it says they confronted him, and they spoke to him, and Jesus answered and said to them. So he's talking to the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders in verse 1. And in verses 2 through 8, he answers them. And he answered them with a question, if you'll recall. In verse 3, it says, they ask him, "Where does your authority come from?" They were expecting him either to say, "From God," and if he said, "From God," then they would accuse him of blasphemy. And if he said, "It came from people," then they would accuse him of being an enemy of the Roman Empire or a rebel in the Roman Empire and turn him over to the Roman authorities. So they thought they were tricking him. But instead, he answered them with another question. In verse 3, Jesus answered and said to them, "I will also ask you a question, and you tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or from men?" Now they figured this out. They said, they reasoned among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, he will say, 'Why did you not believe him?' Because John the Baptist said that Jesus was the Christ." So they can't say that John the Baptist was from heaven because Jesus would just say, "Well, he said, 'I am the Christ, I am the Messiah.' But if we say from men, all the people will stone us to death." Why? Because they thought John the Baptist was a prophet. So here Jesus put them in an untenable position. They couldn't answer. It was a lose-lose situation, as we called it in the business world these days. So in verse 7, so they answered that they did not know where it came from. That is the baptism of John the Baptist. And Jesus said to them, "Nor will I tell you by what authority I do these things." So he answered them with a question that would preclude them from accusing him. Well, now we go on, and he's going to turn from addressing the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, and he's going to address the people. He's going to go over their heads, so to speak, and address the people directly. Remember, Ronald Reagan used to do that. The press would just beat him to death, and he'd go on TV and go to the people and his popularity would just skyrocket again. Well, that's what Jesus is going to do here. He's going to go to the people, and he's going to say this parable. And when he does, what he wants to do here, and the reason for this parable, if you listened along and if you kind of followed the parable, you'll see what he's doing here, is he's warning the people about the evil of their rulership. Their leaders are evil people, and he wants to warn them. So this parable is a parable against the leaders of nation Israel. Not nation Israel itself so much as the scribes, the Pharisees, the chief priests, the elders, the ones who were leaders, the ones who sat in the Sanhedrin, those kind of people. Now, just by way of background for the parable, in the upper Jordan River Valley at this time, along the western and northern shores of Galilee, the Sea of Galilee, there were these vast estates, and they were owned by foreigners. And what they would do, they would give the control of these estates to local people. Now, we do that, we call that sharecropping, if that term means anything yet. But they were like sharecroppers. They would work the land, they would raise the crops, and they'd give a share of the crop to the landowner as his payment for them being on the land. So that's what a sharecropper did. And they had a lot of those in those days. That was very common. Now, this made for problems. And there were problems on both sides of the issue. For the sharecropper, he had a problem of unexpected expenses. Now, if he promised to give the owner of the land a certain amount, and he had unexpected expenses, that was going to cut into his part, you see. And if he had a bad harvest, that would cut into his part. Also, thieves, if somebody stole, then that would cut into his part. Now, on the other hand, the landowners had a problem, and that was the honesty of the sharecroppers. I mean, the landowners were away in another country. They could come for their share, and the sharecropper would say, well, I didn't have a crop this year. Well, he's sitting on all the money that he made from selling the crop. And they also had the problem of the diligence. I mean, sometimes sharecroppers are lazy, and they just don't do their work well. So there were problems on both sides of this, and that's what this parable is going to be working on. The imagery of the parable goes like this. The metaphors of Jesus, remember, they're always appropriate, and they're always biblical. And we'll see this as biblical if you look back in Isaiah chapter 5. And everybody knew Isaiah when Jesus told them this, and we'll see in a moment that it actually states that they know exactly what he's talking about. In Isaiah chapter 5, starting at verse 1, it says, "Let me sing now for my well-beloved, a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. He dug it all around. He removed its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in the middle of it and also hewed out a wine vat in it. Then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done for it?" In other words, God did everything for his vineyard that was possible for him to do. And why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? "So let me tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall, and it will become trampled ground. I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. So we know who the vineyard is. It's the house of Israel, nation Israel. And the men of Judah, his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. So everybody there knew what he was talking about when he talked about a vineyard and the vine growers. The vineyard represents nation Israel. And the owner of the vineyard, of course, is God. So if the owner is God and the sharecropper, so to speak, is Israel, the idea is accountability. It's going to be central in this. The sharecropper is accountable to the person who gave him the land, who did everything for him. And when the owner is absent, as in this case, back to Luke 20 and verse 9, where it says, and he began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard and rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey for a long time. So the owner is absent. He sent three servants to collect what he had contracted from the sharecroppers. We have that at harvest time in verse 10. He sent a slave to the vine growers so that they would give him some of the produce of the vineyard. But the vine growers beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he proceeded to send another slave. In verse 12, he proceeded to send a third. And this one that also they wounded and cast out. So he sent three slaves. Now this is talking about the prophets. And who have we just been talking about? John the Baptist. That's who he's been talking about in 1 through 8. Jesus, remember, he said, I'll ask you a question. Where did the baptism of John come from? And John the Baptist was a perfect example of one of these people that God sent as his representative for what was due him from nation Israel. And how did they treat John the Baptist? Not very well. They cut his head off. And they always killed the prophets. That was just natural for what Israel did. So each one, then, of the slaves was refused, mistreated, and sent away. So just like God's prophets, when they got there, the sharecroppers, who represent the leadership of Israel, sent away the slaves, the representatives of the landowner. So the landowner finally decides to send his own son. It says in verse 13, it says, the owner of the vineyard said, what shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him. Because all of the other people he had sent as his representatives, Israel just gave the boot to. And they were notorious for that throughout the Old Testament, for giving the boot to all the prophets God sent. Remember John 3:16, for God so loved the world that what'd he do? He sent his own son. Look at Romans 8. We'll just look at a couple of these. There's tons of passages we could look at, but Romans 8:32, he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for us. 2 Corinthians 9:15. Thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. What did he do? He sent his own son. So if we take that back to Luke 20 and the parable of the vine growers, the owner decides to send his own son, and that will be Jesus Christ. So he sends his son, and as the son approaches the sharecroppers or the vine growers, what do? They don't see him as a son, but they see him rather as an heir. Verse 14, but when the vine growers saw him, they reasoned with one another, saying, this is the heir. Let us kill him so that the inheritance will be ours. So they assumed that the owner of the land had died and his heir was coming to take possession. So what did they do about it? They got together and said, let's kill the son so we can keep the vineyard. Now, in those days, under law, when an owner and his heirs all died, the sharecropper would have the first chance at the land. So that's, well, we'll take it then. You know, we'll kill the son. That way we'll get the land. So they decided to save the estate for themselves by killing the heir. Now this is the parable. What's the response then going to be of the vineyard owner when he finds out they killed his own son? What's he going to do? He will come and destroy these vine growers, verse 16, and will give the vineyard to others. The owner of the vineyard is God. The vineyard itself is nation Israel, and the vine growers are the leadership of nation Israel. So what did the leadership of nation Israel, what did they try to do when Messiah came? They said, we don't want this guy to take over. I like being in charge of things. We're going to kill him, and then we'll continue to run nation Israel the way we please. And that's exactly what they did. So that's what the parable is all about. Jesus makes an application in verse 17 and 18 when he says, but Jesus looked at them and said, what then is this that is written? The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. So the rejected stone parallels the rejected son in the parable. What happens to the ones who reject the son? What's the owner of the vineyard going to do? Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like dust. So he's going to come and destroy the vine growers, and his son will become the chief cornerstone, and the rejected son becomes the ultimate victor. And that's what this parable is all about. It's not very complicated or difficult. It's just that Jesus is warning the people who are illustrated by the vineyard in this parable that their leadership, that's illustrated by the vine growers, the sharecroppers, are evil, and that God is going to deal with them. So he's warning Israel that your leaders are a bunch of evil people. Now that brings us down to verse 19. We'll have some questions and answers in verse 19 through 26. And what's going to happen is, first, the leadership of Israel tries to have Jesus arrested. Verse 19 says, the scribes and the chief priests tried to lay hands on him that very hour, and they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke this parable against them. They understood perfectly what he was talking about. There's no question that they didn't understand. They knew what Jesus was talking about, and they knew it was directed directly against them as the leadership of nation Israel. So they tried to arrest him. And that little phrase, to lay hands on someone, has the nuance of arresting or detaining to wait for an arrest. Now let's put this guy in custody so he can be arrested. So as the parable ends, there are two things that are clear in everyone's mind. That's the people and the leadership of Israel. They all understand that. And they are First, that Isaiah 5 says, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. So they all know that nation Israel is the vineyard. And Psalm 118:22 says that the stone which the builders rejected is the chief cornerstone. That's a quote, as you can see in verse 17. The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. And that's a direct quote from Psalm 118:22. So, everybody knows what the parable means. And the scribes and the chief priests knew very well that this parable was directed against them. And verse 19 comes right out and says that. It says, the scribes and the chief priests tried to lay hands on him that very hour, and they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke this parable against them. So they knew very well. Their reaction then was an attempt to arrest him. In verse 19, they tried to lay their hands on him, tried to arrest him, but it didn't work out. And why not? The result of that was, well, the people held Jesus to be a prophet. So the leaders had to be very careful how they dealt with him. Because 3 days ago, in the triumphal entry, they had been shouting praise to Jesus, all of nation Israel. So the leaders, they're like the leaders of our country, aren't they? You know, what's your opinion? Well, let me see. You know, which way is the wind blowing? And they're not going to do anything that upsets the people because it might turn out bad for them. In fact, they might get stoned is what they come to the conclusion of. It was Passover week. Remember, they were in town for Passover week, and the political enthusiasm would be at its very peak at that time. And here they worshiped as a hero, as a prophet, Jesus, and that would be tough to overcome, even for the Sanhedrin, even for the leading organization of nation Israel. And remember that the raising of Lazarus had just occurred, and that had brought a whole nother group. Look over at John chapter 12. And we looked at this when we were in John. In John 12, verse 10 and 11, we'll look at verse 9. It says, the large crowd of the Jews then learned that he was there, and they came, not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he raised from the dead. But the chief priests planned to put Lazarus to death also. Why'd they want to do that? Well, Jesus just raised him from the dead. They figured, well, if we kill him, then nobody will know. But the people found out. And in verse 11 it says, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and were believing in Jesus. So they were leaving what the rulers told them to do, and they were becoming converts to Jesus. Look at verse 17. So the people who were with him, when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead, continued to testify about him. For this reason also, the people went and met him, because they heard that he had performed this sign. So the Pharisees said to one another, you see that you are not doing any good. Look, the world has gone after him. So all of Israel now is on Jesus' side. Like I said, they're a fickle group. They won't stay there long. But right now, they're all on his side. The religious leaders are now at a point of absolute rage, but it's impotent rage because there's nothing they can do about it. They couldn't arrest Jesus because he was so popular among the people. So they're at a point right now where they're close to apoplexy, I would imagine, because they're so frustrated they want to arrest this guy and they can't do it because the people won't let him. So they change tactics here. And In verse 20, we'll see a shift in tactics. First, they tried to arrest him. They couldn't do it. He was just too popular. So they ask some questions. And they're going to be real sneaky here. And the two questions are going to be in Luke 20, 20 through 26 will be the first one. Look at verse 22, where it says, "Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" That's the first question. Second question is in Luke 20, 27 through 40. Look at verse 33, where we have the question, "In the resurrection, therefore, which one's wife will she be? For all seven had married her." And we'll see what that question entails as we go through this context. But those are the two questions that are designed to trap Jesus. And that's the plan. Starting in verse 20, they abandon the head-on attack against Jesus. And when they do that, they'll try a more subtle approach. They will pretend sincerity. So instead of sending members of the ruling body of Israel, the chief priests, the scribes, the elders, the ones who ran the Sanhedrin, instead of sending them, they send a smaller group of their disciples. You have to go to Matthew for that. Look at Matthew 22. In the same story, we need to add that fact. In Matthew 22:16, it says, "And they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians, saying, 'Teacher, we know that you are truthful and teach the way of God in truth and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any.'" They pretend sincerity. Now, these younger men could go now. Look at verse 15. It says, "Then the Pharisees went and plotted together how they might trap him in what he said." So the Pharisees are involved. Now, the Pharisees, the scribes, and the elders, the chief priests, that would be the Sadducees, the whole group of leadership was now plotting against Jesus. And they couldn't arrest him because he was too popular. So they hatched this plot. They said, "We'll take some young guys and they'll go and pretend to be sincere and just want to find out things. And we'll give some questions to him to ask Jesus that'll trick him. And then we can arrest him." And that's their plan from the beginning. And of course, Jesus knows that from the beginning. So they're going to pretend sincerity. They're going to pose as just people seeking the truth. Now, it's kind of interesting that they came along with a group of Herodians. Herodians and the Sanhedrin were bitter enemies, and yet they went together because they both hated Jesus. Did you ever hear the old saying, "The enemy of my enemy is my friend"? That's exactly what's applicable here. Because they both hated Jesus, they said, "Okay, let's get together to kill this guy, and then we can go back to our own bickering, you know." So the two enemies join in fellowship to destroy Jesus, and that's their plan from the beginning. They're not seeking truth. They don't want to find out anything. They want to trick Jesus so they can have him arrested. That's their sole purpose in sending these guys. Now, Jesus had just silenced the leadership of Israel by putting them in a dilemma. Remember in chapter 20, verse 5 and 6, when he had asked them about the baptism of John? In verse 5, they reasoned among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven," that is that the baptism of John was from heaven, "he will say, 'Why did you not believe him?' Because he said Jesus was Messiah." We went through that. "But if we say from men, all the people will stone us to death, for they're convinced that John was a prophet." So there's their options. You know, if they say that the baptism of John was from heaven, then why didn't they believe him when he said that Jesus was Messiah? they say he wasn't, then the people are going to stone him because they thought John was a prophet. So there's no escape. So they thought, well, we'll do the same thing to Jesus. We'll give him a question that if he answers one way, we'll have him, and if he answers the other way, we'll also have him. So that's their plot. They're even going to flatter him. They're going to practice flattery, and this is totally insincere flattery. So we have the first question in chapter 20, verse 21 through 26. In 21 and 22, they ask the question. Verse 21, they question him, saying, "Teacher, we know that you speak and teach correctly, and you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" See how they flatter him? Actually, it says, "You don't receive faces of any," is how the Greeks put it. But in verse 21, it says, "We know that you speak and teach correctly, and you are not partial to any." You don't receive a face, is how they say it in Greek. So they're practicing flattery, and that's the background for their hypocrisy. In other words, they're saying the very best things. Everything they say here is true of Jesus, isn't it? Everything they say is true, and they say these things, very good things, from the very worst of motives, because they're just trying to flatter him so that they can draw him into the trap. Now, a little background on the question they ask, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? The poll tax is what they're talking about, and the poll tax was collected from the Roman procurator. A procurator was a governor of a province of Rome, and he was appointed by the Roman Senate. So Judea would be a province, and they would have a Roman procurator because they were a subject nation of Rome. And he would collect this poll tax from every adult male in Judea. Now, the coinage they used for this tax was the denarius. And he's going to say, "Bring me a denarius." Now, remember, we talked about the coinage they used for the temple tax, and that was a Tyrian shekels that they used for the temple tax. And Tyre was a city in the Phoenician Empire, and the Phoenician god was Baal, so the coins they used in the temple had an image of Baal on the front of them, on the obverse side. Well, the coinage used for this tax now was the denarius. Now, the denarius, the obverse side of the coin, had an image of the emperor on it. It would have been one of these two. It would have been the denarius of Caesar Augustus or Tiberius Caesar. And his image would be on the front, and on the reverse side would be the inscription Pontiff Maxim, which means high priest. So on the front, there he is with his victor's crown on. That shows his absolute political rule of the Roman Empire. And on the back was the Pontiff Maxim, which meant he was also the high priest. In fact, he claimed deity. So he was the head of the political and the head of the religious, both. That reminded the Jews, you go to pay your poll tax, you have to pay it with a denarius that had the emperor's picture on it, that they were a conquered nation. It had to be hard to swallow for them to pay, just like it was hard to swallow to pay the temple tax in Phoenician coinage, in Tyrian shekels, because it had a picture of an anti-god on it. Payment of this tax would be extremely distasteful for any devout Jew because it had an image of the emperor on it and it showed them that they were a conquered nation. In fact, there was one Jew of the day and his name was Judas, but it wasn't the same Judas that was in the 12. It was Judas of Galilee. And he made the statement that to pay the tax was nothing less than treason to God. So they were very uncomfortable paying this tax. Now, here's the dilemma that this question, or what the people who asked the question wanted to present to Jesus. If Jesus said, pay the tax, then he would alienate the Jewish followers. So they figured, now if he says pay that tax, then all these people who like him so much aren't going to like him anymore. Then we can take care of him, the Sanhedrin, the leaders of Israel, because he won't have the popularity that he had before. So that's what would happen if he said, go ahead and pay the tax. If he said, don't pay the tax, then he could be accused of being a rebel against the Roman Empire, and they could turn him over to the Romans and say, this guy says we're not supposed to pay the tax. See the dilemma that they're trying to put him in? This is just a trick question. There's no question about it. It's a trick question. And how does he answer it? We'll find that out next week. Now, noodle on this. Read ahead a little, see the answer, and we'll talk about it next week. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for this wonderful history we have in the book of Luke. We pray that we can understand it correctly and be very careful in our interpretations, in our exegesis of this book. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.